This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Aloha. Aloha. Welcome to the Lannan Foundation series, lecture series called In Pursuit of Cultural Freedom. I wanted to begin by thanking the Lannan Foundation for sponsoring this ceremony of honoring for our dear sister and friend Winona LaDuke, and for bringing me all the way from Hawaii so that I could participate. For many years, I have worked with Winona for 35 years, and many of the things that she'll be talking about tonight are things that she's shared with many women, such as myself. Tonight, the Lannan Foundation has asked me to do something impossible. I have 10 minutes, during which time I'm to give you a briefing about who Winona LaDuke is, what her accomplishments are, and the honors that she has received. I know that I will not be able to succeed in that, but nevertheless, I'm going to give it my best try. Winona was born in 1959, the year that Hawaii became a state of the Union. Her father, Vincent LaDuke, was a member of the White Earth Band of Anishinaabe Aking people. Their reservation is in Minnesota. Her mother, Betty LaDuke, was an artist and also an activist who worked with women of Africa. When you see her art, beautiful murals, all in bright colors, depicting the indigenous women of Africa. When her parents divorced, she went to live with her mom in Ashland, Oregon, and that is where she was raised. Winona is a product of the public schools, at least until her college years occurred, and then she went to Harvard. She graduated in 1982 with a degree in rural economics, and later, a few years, got her master's from Antioch, also in community development. This, I think, is one of her great strengths, because there are few leaders, especially those among indigenous women, that have this type of credential, that have returned to help their people and to help in the work of human rights. One of the things that Winona has done in her life is that she has created many organizations that continue to do the work of human rights, of environmental protection, opposition to racial injustice, and also to uplift indigenous women and to restore them to their appropriate places. In 1985, Winona took the step of forming a collective of indigenous women of the Americas. She reached out to Hawaii. She brought women not only from Alaska, but also from the remaining American colonies, from American Samoa, from Guam, and from Puerto Rico. She did this because she wanted to form an indigenous women's network so that we could share our experience, our knowledge, and work more collectively to better our communities. One of our goals was to achieve economic self-sufficiency by returning our peoples to traditional enterprises, by bringing back to our peoples their traditional diet, which linked to and which was conditional the foundation for our people's health. That was in 1985, and 2 years later, she fulfilled a lifelong dream. She had gone back to White Earth after she had gotten her degrees. When she went back to White Earth, she was someone who was not really known there, but she had made a commitment that she would return to the land of her bloodlines. Her father had enrolled her as a member of the Anishinaabe Aking Nation of the White Earth Reservation when she was just a child. But she herself had not been raised there. And so she took everything she had, including her degrees, and she went back to that traditional community. And you can imagine, it was difficult coming in to an indigenous traditional community, because you had the koko, you had the blood, but no one there really knew her. In the years that elapsed, she would become not only a leader in that community, but she would become someone who achieved a goal that they had sought for many years. The Anishinaabe, a king people, by treaty had been given 860,000 acres of land by treaty given to them by the Congress. But later, when the Congress passed the Nelson Act, 90% of their tribal lands were taken and sold to those who are not native. Winona had a dream that she would go back and put together a project to reclaim those lands, and she did just that at White Earth. In fact, one of the things she did was she took the money that she won from the Reebok Human Rights Award that was given to her, and she put it into the project. Within a few years, White Earth had regained back 10,000 acres. They purchased their land back, and they continue to this day to do that. She also made good with another promise on White Earth. Today, the folks at White Earth are employing their native people, and they're selling organic white rice, wild rice. It is called menamen. It is not only being marketed here in the United States, but as far away as the slow food movement in Turin, Italy. They market not only the wild rice, but also the maple syrup that is famous from that area. This project has brought back pride to her people and provided addressed unemployment by providing needed jobs. Now they have returned to traditional agriculture. One of the greatest achievements, I think, for Winona was her work collectively with the Indigo Girls. It started in 1993. She formed a partnership with Amy Ray, the Indigo Girls, who are not Native women, but they came together because they shared something, concern for the local community, a concern for environmental issues that were not being addressed. And they saw that everywhere there were small nonprofits in the community struggling to address these issues. This is how the Honor the Earth Project started. This is our 26th year with the Honor the Earth Project. They travel broadly throughout the United States, and by using music and art, they raise funds and give out grants to the small community nonprofits so that they can continue their work, environmental justice. The Honor the Earth Project was so successful that it was recognized by Ms. Magazine, 1998. They named Winona LaDuc the Woman of the Year, recognizing her work there. That was only one of the many, many honors that Winona has received. Winona was nominated by Time Magazine in the early 1990s. She was named as one of America's 50 most promising women leaders under 40 years of age. The following year, she got the Thomas Merton Award. In 1997, she was awarded the Beeha Community Service Award. And then in 1998, she received the Reebok Human Rights Award. You know, one of the funny things about Winona is that she has worked with many, many people in this country and internationally. But when you read her work and when you read what people have written about her, you have to wonder what this woman really is all about. When you read those who have commented about her work, you know, some say that she is an environmentalist and an advocate for climate change. Others say that she is an indigenous feminist, and they cite her work about Native women and the religious practices that guide them in their work. Many people believe that she is kind of a new age anti-globalization economist, a woman who has linked a stable economy with sustainable development and also sustainable employment. And one of the things that Winona has said is that when you have a country such as the United States that is consuming the vast resources of the world, you can see clearly that it will not be sustainable, not for our country and not for any other. Winona LaDuc does not generally describe herself in this way. I remember back in 1995, three things happened. We heard one day that the United Nations was convening the fourth global consultation on women, that this would be held in Beijing, China. The following day, the president announced that the United States would send a delegation of 800 women from America to participate in the global consultation. And the day after that, Winona announced that she was convening a gathering of Native American indigenous women so that we would have our rightful place in the delegation of the United States, which was being led by Hillary Clinton. We had a huge meeting. We met regionally, and then we had a national meeting. It was in upstate New York, and women came from all over. We presented at the World Conference on 50 different topics. We took with us 10 white papers. The women that were working with the media went crazy, and they came and saw us as we ended the meeting, and they said, look, the press has been calling for 3 days. They need to have a press statement. They need something that is a short and concise soundbite, and we can't summarize it in that way. What can we do? Well, the rest of us did what we always did, which was step back and push Winona up to the mic. And Winona, just in her pace, made a very profound statement. She said, we cannot summarize the issues that we will present on, nor can we summarize the 10 white papers. But they will understand if you tell them that we are doing what we have always done. We are going to China. We will follow the original instructions of the Creator. We will walk and speak with honor. We will represent our peoples with integrity. We will expose the injustices, but we will bring with us opportunities for creative solutions that will maintain peace and perpetrate peace in our community. That one statement that she made, I think, is the best tag that you can give to Winona LaDuc. And now my great pleasure and honor to bring to the podium a woman who is a true speaker, a woman who has walked in the light of her culture, who has always served her people with integrity, and in the process, who has opened up her heart to sisters from across this country and many indigenous peoples. It's something that you cannot really appreciate here because you are from America. But if you could hear the statements of the Indian sisters, if you could hear what the Sami of reindeer country say of Winona, you would know truly that she is one that has walked in the light of her culture. She is truly a truth speaker. My great honor to introduce and bring to the podium Winona LaDuc.
Thank you so much for coming tonight. And that woman has been one of the greatest inspirations in my life. We've known each other for a good 35 years. We've traveled far together. And many times I think, what would Millie Lonnie do? And so it was very wonderful that Lannan has brought us together in this forum and that you are all here. Although I cannot see you, I'm sure you are there. Anin in Dinaway Maganatak, Nigagoyitamagas, Mine Sique to go Makwandodam, Gababani Kag, Ishkana Gining and Dunjiba Miigwich. Thank you very much again for the honor of being here tonight, and with great gratitude to the Lannan Foundation. And there are many people out there that I know, and I am always grateful to come here to this territory because I will tell you that I learned a great deal when I came here as a young woman. I came here first in 1978. And I worked for the New Mexico Indian Environmental Education Project and John Redhouse. And we worked on uranium mining at the time. They were trying to expand dramatically the number of uranium mines in this area. There was 44 uranium mines and 10 uranium mills. And I came down as a young kind of geeky woman from Harvard I was kind of an energy geek. You know, I don't know how it's a long story how I got that, but I came down and I said, I want to work for these people. And in my life down here, you know, as a young woman, The Diné people, the Pueblo people, took very good care of me, and I will be forever indebted to them for what they have added to my humanity and to my instructions as a person to do the best you can. So thank you again for inviting me here. As I reflected on what I would say as I came to be with you today, I just want to start by saying that I began to find my voice as a writer at Garcia's Kitchen in Albuquerque. That is to say that, you know, as a grassroots community organizer, I think Ida Gordon is here. I slept on her couch. I slept on John Redhouse's couch. You know, this was the late 70s, American Indian Movement. You know, it was part of, very influential in my training and in my upbringing. You know, I always value my Harvard education, my time at MIT, but I value more my indigenous education. Whether it was the political knowledge I gained from the state and the lay of the land, being a young woman coming into this time, and the time of the Farmington riots and the treatment of Diné people, and the time of the American Indian Movement. But I spent a lot of time as a young person sleeping on people's couches. And then we had an office that was right across from Garcia's Kitchen on Central. You know, and I don't know, it's still got these bars, and I was really skinny then. I was like 30 pounds lighter because I was 24. So, you know, actually, I was like 19, you know, a super skinny little thing. And so for a while, I lived in my office. Did any of you ever live in your office before? I live in my office. We were super poor. I live in my office, you know. And so I had all this writing and like all these facts and all these things, and I was trying to figure out how to write in some way. And so I didn't really have any money, so I'd sleep in my office, and sometimes I could slip underneath the bars. That's how skinny I was, to get out, you know. And I'd go and sit in Garcia's Kitchen and drink coffee and eat tortillas for 4 hours or 5 hours, and they put up with me. So I'm saying that because that is perhaps... It is here that I found my voice as a writer. Let me tell you a little bit about the process of consciousness in that. I began to write because I wanted to inform people, because I believe that society, civil society, and democracy is best served by informed people, that we have a right to know what is going on. And all those who are here, we know that often, you know, there is a lot of Kool-Aid that is going around, a lot of people drinking the Kool-Aid. There's a lot of Fox News that goes around. There's a lot of babble, you know. I was thinking about it. I'm writing an article now about simplicity, and I was thinking about it. I actually don't know how many Kardashians there are. I'm not sure that it is relevant. But it is still something that you find, like, that is how much babble there is in our society. And it just astounds me. And so, you know, it is hard to be an informed person in this day and age unless you can kind of weed through that. And so as a young woman at Harvard, I used to work at this place called the Center for Science and International Affairs. And it was pretty much a think tank for the CIA, from what I can figure. I was their librarian. And I would serve these lunches. I would put together these lunches, and these guys would come in from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Atomic Energy Commission and the International Atomic Energy Commission and the Los Alamos Scientific Labs. And I just remember I would serve these men lunch. And, of course, it was all white men, and I was the brown person, which seems like that's how things are at Harvard probably still today. So I would bring out the lunch, and I'd sit there, and then they would let me listen. And I remember my first, like, I'd say politicization was this moment when these guys were talking about, from Los Alamos, they were talking about a cost-benefit analysis of limited nuclear war. And you know, I thought to myself, now that there's something profoundly wrong about this. You know, who is in charge of this thinking? And, you know, that was kind of my first lead up to the fact we might have some flaws in our democracy. But then I remember these guys from Los Alamos this other time saying this little report, which I'm not sure if the government of New Mexico or, you know, other places that still consider uranium mining have been paying attention to, but there was this 1978 study that came out from Los Alamos that said, perhaps the solution to the radon emission problem is to zone the land into uranium mining and milling districts so as to forbid human habitation. Now that would be a very important fact to know, that the government was proposing that as a strategy when Exxon, United Nuclear, and all these oil companies, Kerr McGee, were coming to your territory to propose new uranium mines. And so my job as a young woman was initially to take my writing skills and was to turn kind of what I call government ease, which still exists. You know, it is like the babble in which government documents are written in that changes all the time, from millirams to, you know, it is like all this changing, recommended daily allowances of pollutants. You know what I'm saying? Or radiation counts, picocuries. You know, a normal person cannot understand this. And so my job was to take these things that were written in this crazy way and to try to take them into common English so that I could understand it. And then I would go with John Redhouse and George Harrison. That was our attorney at the time. Not the guy, the Beatle guy, but the attorney guy. And we would go out, and they'd drive out there, and we would explain these issues. I would give these written papers out, like, you know, fact sheet. And then they would take them and translate them into Navajo. And that is when I came to understand that there was not a word for radiation in Navajo. And that is when I came to this understanding that there was no way to make informed consent for people if you could not tell them what was going to happen to them. And so it was this moment of politicization which occurred. And that was really the beginning of my writing, the idea that people had a right to know what was happening to them, and the idea that stories that occurred in these communities that were so far from the view of the public, so far from the view of the government, or so far from everyone's view, that those stories had a right to see the light of day, and that others would not only feel compassion in hearing those stories, but they would learn something about what would be, in fact, a collective threat to all of us. And so that's how I began to write. And I started writing, and I'd write at Garcia's Kitchen, and then I'd go back. This was the day, a lot of you are my age, you know, I wrote by hand, and then we had that. If you were really lucky, you got the Selectric typewriter. Remember the Selectric typewriter? That was very nice. And then there was all that whiteout. Sometimes my articles had more whiteout in them than actually, you know, that was the day. And so that's how I wrote. And then, you know, I started trying to write more about our issues and what was going on, mostly in this territory. And then I was called to work in up in South Dakota for the Lakota people fighting uranium mining as well. I started to write for them. I started to write more. And then I realized that there was this block. And when I first realized this block was with a magazine called In These Times, which is still in publication today, a very nice journal. But I remember submitting an article to them. And they said to me, we wrote about Indians last month. And I thought to myself, okay, that's, you know, what does that tell you? What does that tell you as a Native person? It's like, we have our quota of Indians already. We're not covering Indians again for another year. I don't know what that is supposed to mean. But that is, in fact, in some ways, still exists, you know, in the media. You know, that there is this absence of coverage of the courageous people that exist in our communities. You know, the remarkable stories of resilience and the remarkable stories of courage in all of these years that are in these communities. And so, you know, that was kind of my first lesson on how things were going to work. And then I remember them telling me also, it was an interesting thing when they told me that I was biased. So I tried to understand what that meant. So my question to them was, does that mean that only black people can write about white people? I mean, what is that bias, you know? I didn't really understand what they meant, you know, that a Native person could not write about Native people. You know, and this is what you begin to deal with when you are a young Native writer. And I didn't, you know, come into this. I was an economist. I didn't come into intending to be a writer. But anybody who knows me now knows that I love to write more than just about anything. And that is a little of where it came from, is this tension that existed even in where we would consider them to be our most progressive allies in the media, that they too had compartmentalized and limited our ability to have our voices heard. And so I began to write, and I would write, and I would write, but then I decided I would write for Native people, because I felt that we needed to hear our stories, and we needed to write about our stories, and we needed to be, you know, tell our stories in the ways that we wanted to tell our stories. And so that is really, you know, how it started for me. I looked around, and I saw that our stories were not unique. You know, it is that moment of consciousness that arises. You know, as a young person, I was raised in a small town in southern Oregon. You know, my mother, a very intelligent, progressive woman. But, you know, in the town I was raised in, like a lot of other kind of towns, you know, they used to always talk about the Indian problem. That's how they referred to it, as the Indian problem. And I know my mother would march into the school, the number of times my mother came to school. You know, as a mother myself, I always remind my children when I show up at their school for some complex racial overtones that are brought forth by the privileged white administration that, you know, you would think 40, 50 years later you would not have to do again, but you do. My mother would go into that school and always challenge them on what they were saying. But, you know, this depth of consciousness really came to me as a young woman. And I, you know, in experiencing first, you know, working in different indigenous communities that I knew little about, and then the moment that I was born into, you know, the moment that I was born into, and my good friend Ida Gordon is here, is a moment when there was this anti-colonial movement. You know, a lot of you are my age. So there was, for instance, the coup in Chile and the nationalization of the copper companies by the Chilean government. You know, that occurred in OPEC when countries and people said, you cannot steal our resources anymore. They are ours. They will benefit our people first. And that is, you know, how the future will look. And that is in the early 70s when that occurred. So a lot of those major multinational corporations came home to roost here. They came back because they saw that there was still loopholes in federal leasing policies, where there would be 380 uranium leases on Indian and federal lands and only 4 on public and acquired lands. And that would be because the government had this little special place for Native people. So I was fortunate to be born into this time when this politicization occurred internationally. And I was privileged as a young woman, first at the age of 18, to go to the United Nations with my little notepad to present my testimony and to hear people talk, you know, at that moment in history, the first UN conference on the rights of indigenous people. The first time that indigenous people said, we also have human rights as people. That was 77. And for those of you who are in the room, you know that it took 30 years till 2007 for the UN to pass the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. But I remember that moment when we stood there for the first time, and I also remember that moment 30 years later when it was recognized that we had rights as people. So it is this moment you were born into in history, and then you ask yourself as a writer, what should you do with that? What is your responsibility in this moment? How do you tell those stories? How do you nurture this movement? And so that is where I found myself. I found myself in rooms as a young woman, you know, learning your geography by sitting next to the Polisario from the Sahara Desert, or the African National Congress in the room with you, or the, you know, Southwest, you know, all of the different liberation movements were there. The Palestinians were there. And recognizing that indigenous people, too, had rights as a movement in an international arena. And then you look to history and you found great writers, also who have been highly regarded by the Lannan Foundation. And I think of my friend, or someone who I have always wished to sit at his feet, Eduardo Galeano. Many years ago, he wrote, in the colonial to neocolonial alchemy Gold changes to scrap metal and food to poison. We have become painfully aware of the mortality of wealth, which nature bestows and imperialism appropriates. He wrote that about Latin America, but that is very much the story of our indigenous communities. Because of what little land we have left, it is still always at prey. It is always at prey by multinational corporations and governments. I think about it because a few years ago, I lose track, it is longer than that. I sat in a meeting with a Canadian Indian leader, Nuchalnith leader, a chief of the Nuchalnith band. And he was talking to me and he said, "You know, Winona," he said, "sitting down to talk with the Canadian government is a little bit like sitting down to talk with a cannibal." You can make as much small talk as you want, but in the end, you know exactly what they're after. And so that is a story that I often find myself telling. When asked to write, I started, as I said, writing in the broad community, and then I decided to write for Native people. And so I have this privilege in my life, which is that I travel, I wander, and I get to go from one community to another, both in my work as the executive director of Honor the Earth, and also as in my privilege as a writer and as a speaker. So I go to communities, and I hear stories. I hear these stories, and then people ask me to help tell their story. You know, and so that is the responsibility that I've felt like I've had in my life. This question of how, from obscurity, where violence can occur against a people in darkness, one is able to take that, put shine light on that, and say that no more darkness is here, and no more pain should occur. And so that is a lot of the work that I've tried to do in these times. I've written mostly, as I said, for Native people, though. And I wrote a lot of times, you know, in my first book, some of which are available here, All My Relations, or All Our Relations. In that book, my editor, in that one, and at formerly South End Press and now Haymarket, said, "Can you explain these things more for a non-Native audience?" And I said, "No." You know, they should study up before they read. You know, how many times must Native writers explain things down for lazy readers? You know, it is time that people begin, and do not make a start sheet with step one. We are all responsible as first world privileged people for our intelligence. You know, do not make me explain things. Even today, people ask me sometimes for an interview, I say, "Go to Wikipedia and then come back and talk to me when you're done." You know, it is wearisome. It is wearisome. So, because I would rather talk about the things that I think are so important. So let me talk a little bit about the themes of my writing that I think many of you know. You know, the first I would say is always about the land. I'm drawn to our land, as we all are. The Creator gave us a beautiful place upon which to live. And I would like to see our land be that beautiful place. You know, we are here for such a short period of time as human beings. And in that short period of time, we kind of bumble along and hopefully we do good. But that land knows so much more. It has stories. Those trees have stories. Those rocks have stories. They have seen so many beings pass by. And so often, that is the history that interests me the most, the history of the land. And that is how I like to tell my stories. And in that, there are many, many sacred places. You know, and I find it so interesting because, you know, today, in the battle to protect a place like Oak Flats, you know, or to protect our sacred wild rice in northern Minnesota, I find that one of the challenges we face is not only the historical amnesia of Americans, but more than that, the absolute lack of knowledge as to where they are. So what I mean by this is that, you know, there are places, like in our territory, there's a place known as a place where the thunder beings rest in their migration from west to east. There is a place in this territory known as the place where the Great Salt Mother lives. A place in the north known as the place where life begins. These are places that are sacred places to our people. The place that is known as the place where the thunder beings rest on their migration is a mountain outside of what is today known as the city of Thunder Bay, Ontario. The city and the bay retain the name, but the mountain itself is not known as the Mountain of the Thunder Beings, and our people continue to go there with our prayer offerings for those thunder beings. Instead of being known as that, it is known as Mount McKay, which brings me to one of my pet peeves about America, which is the naming of large mountains after small men. And anybody that knows me knows that I love men. I have four sons, you know, and I have a great companion. And yet at the same time, but what is it in that? You know, the naming of these, you know, what is that? You know, because human beings blow through here for 50, 60 years. We are, you know, why could you name something as immortal as a mountain after something as mortal as a human? You know, baffling to me. But it does something to how people relate to the world, all of this naming. You know, and there are a lot of places that are named after bad guys. You know, Pike's Peak, and one place, you know, in my lifetime, it is not really for me to do, but in my lifetime, I would really like them to quit calling that Kit Carson National Forest. You know, Kit Carson did nothing for the ecology of this region. He burned the orchards of the people. He destroyed ecology. Do not name something after him. You know, and in this historical amnesia, in this naming, something significant is lost. And that, to me, is one of the things that must be undone to really become people who live here on this Turtle Island, is we must undo that naming. Is it possible? Yeah. You know, you and I know in our history we have seen some things. Like, for instance, that used to be Mount McKinley. What is that called now?
Denali!
That is right. See, it is Mount Denali. And then there is, you know, places like, it used to be called Ayers Rock. I have no idea who that Ayers guy was, that big rock in the middle of Australia, right? And now, you know, they call that Uluru. That's their name for it. You know, much more appropriate. And then there's some crazy guys that got whole territories named after them, like that Rhodes Scholar guy. You know, he got Rhodesia named after him. He didn't even, like, he wasn't even happy with just a mountain. He had to have one country, right? You know, Rhodesia, Zimbabwe today. But you see things like, you know, most recently the Queen Charlotte Islands, you know, was well renamed. It was named Haida Gwaii, which is appropriate. For 10,000 years they lived there. And I missed, in my colonial history, I actually missed who Queen Charlotte was. So, you know, I'm interested in stories on land and in the naming and renaming. I'm interested in stories of sacred beings and sacred beings. I live at a place which is near the headwaters of the Buffalo River, the Buffalo River on my reservation, also the Mississippi River. And in that, I think often of those beings and what we have lost. 50 million buffalo. Largest migratory herd in the history of the world, changed the ecology of a region, and their thunder of their hooves would ignite the beauty and the power of the earth in a dance. You know, to me, that is a remarkable, just an amazing, amazing gift to think of that. You know, that is what was once there in the northern plains. And today we have nothing left of buffalo, very few. They are still killing them at Yellowstone National Park. And where once there was 250 species of grass, they are down to many single-field monocrops owned by Monsanto and Cargill. You know, that massive loss of life is a great loss to all of us. And I think often, you know, in the gifts of my life, of how in visiting with Lakota people, they taught me the buffalo kill ceremony so that when we would kill a buffalo, we would do that with regard. But think of the karmic and spiritual wrong that has been done, that no buffalo kill ceremony was done for those buffalo. You know, I think of that, and I think of how it is that we will, you know, recover that. In some of my writing, I write about that recovery. my own family. You know, At the time I had 4 kids with me. I have 3 biological children. Each of them asked me to adopt their best friend. So I have 6, but then I come home now, there are 7 in the house. You leave an extra bed and a child moves in. So that's good. That's good. I have 7 children. It is all good. But at one time there was 4 of us, 4 children. And on my reservation, we had lost our sturgeon. I went up into Canada to see my friends at the Rainy River Reserve. And I had heard, I went there for ceremonies, and then I heard of this man there. His name is Joe Hunter. And he had the sturgeon hatchery, largest sturgeon hatchery in Canada. And it was renowned sturgeon hatchery. So I begged to go see this guy because I really like sturgeon, you know. And I go see him and I meet him and they call him the Sturgeon General of Canada. So I'm hanging out with the Sturgeon General looking at the sturgeon and I'm petting them. They're just gentle creatures, just, you know, they're 250 million years old. Like, that's some old fish, you know? They're like, I'm petting them, and they're having sturgeon sex, which I'm not sure how that occurs, but they have the eggs, and then they, you know what I'm saying, they get the eggs, and you know, I don't know, I don't want to be part of that whole thing, but anyway, I pet the sturgeon, and I say, Joe, I want some sturgeon to take home. He says, okay, come back. So I go back the next week with 4 children, 1, 2 Coleman coolers, 1 bubbly thing that hooks to my car lighter in an Aerostar van. And I drive over there to Rainy River Reserve, Manitou Rapids, and I, you know, visit with them. And they give me 5 sturgeon to take home. And I say, well, Joe, what do I say when I hit customs at the border? And he says, just say they're your pets. And so, you know, I write about this, but that is how we brought our sturgeon home, and we put them in our lake, you know, those 1st sturgeon. And then, about a week, 2 weeks later, I timed it a little bit to give a pause. I go to see my tribal government. I just want you to know the sequence. I go see my tribal fisheries biologist. And this is what he does when he sees me. He says, do you have any idea of how many laws you just violated? You know, international transport of endangered species. He's like citing these laws to me. His name is Randy Zortman. And I said, Randy, there is the white man's law and there's the creator's law. And those sturgeon knew no border. They come from our ecosystem, they come from our territory, and they need to come home. I said, we have sturgeon clan people here who have no relatives in our territory. And so that is how they came home. And now my tribe has the largest sturgeon restoration program in the region. So, because I am a woman of faith, you know, I believe in this. But you have to tell these stories. You have to tell the story of how it happened, of how you didn't ask permission and it was okay. Because we have become to be people who almost have to ask permission to do anything. And that is folly. Because the people you are often asking permission to have no right to grant you permission. Yeah. So, how I knew that we had done the right thing was 9 years ago, my 1st grandchild arrived, my 1st biological grandchild. And do you want to know what clan that child was? Sturgeon. And then when he was a little dude, I took him down there and I said, look what grandma got you. All your relatives are here. And so, it is that story. And then you have a responsibility to those guys. Yeah, your responsibility to the sturgeon is to keep their water clean. I did not bring them home to have it contaminated by oil companies. We did not do that. And so you do that work, and then you pray. And I'm always grateful for that. And I think about that, and I think of that guy. I forget his name, but Mr. Emoto. Everybody knows who Mr. Emoto is, right? The guy who prays and sings to the water, right? And that makes me know and reaffirms faith that, you know, you will pray and you will do good. So I write primarily nonfiction. I love to write, and there are so many fabulous stories to tell. And the writing about nonfiction, the problem of writing nonfiction is that the story doesn't end. You know, you write the story and then something changes and you're like, darn it, I missed that, or dang, I got to go do another piece of that. So then, you know, stories of that are stories, for instance, of, you know, I wrote a story many years ago about the Seminole Nation and that lived deep, deep in the forest in the Everglades and their life there. And, you know, for people who had removed themselves from society, you know, and the Lannan Foundation is friends with those people, you know, they would have a right, you would think, to just continue their existence the way that the Creator intended for them to be. But today, in the time of global climate destabilization and agriculture, now new flooding in the Everglades will affect those people. People letting go of those giant snakes go through the Everglades. You know, it is crazy stuff. So I wrote the story 15 years ago, and the story changes, you know, as it goes now. And sometimes I write stories that are waiting for an ending. There's a story that my sister Millie Lonnie asked me to tell you, which, you know, I spent a lot of time on Pine Ridge Reservation, you know, in my life. I owe them, those people, a great debt as well. And I was out east one time, and I heard that there was this collection of items from Wounded Knee, in Barrie, at the Barrie Library in Barrie, Massachusetts. And so I went with a friend of mine. I went on this road trip, you know, up there by the Quabbin Reservoir, way over there. I find this place, Barrie. I go there. I schedule to go see. And there is this collection of, I cannot remember, maybe 100 separate items of clothing and shoes and treasures and locks of hair that were collected on the battlefield at Wounded Knee. And they were given there by a man who was from that village. And I asked the woman, really nice woman, you know, fine Yankee stock, I asked her how the items got there. And she told me that the natives were coming to Wounded Knee and that they knew that things were not going to go well, and so they removed their clothing before they arrived at Wounded Knee to surrender. And, you know, and so I remember what she said, and she is a good person, you know, but, and I didn't, it was one of those moments of the shock of not only amnesia, but how you could make up such a myth and carry it on in your little community so far from everything. You know, and I said, you know, this should go back to those people, to her. And she said, well, you know, we really like these things here. And they are not subject to NAGPRA because it is a private collection. And there is a lot of that is out there, things that should come home to people. And I said, you know, what you should do is you should get a big grant. You should hire the Lakotas to make replicas, and you could have a replica collection, you know. But to me, you know, and that is a story that I told. It is still not finished. And one day, those, you know, babies' moccasins need to come home. Those things that belong to those families need to come home. And so I told that story because it needed to be told. But, you know, anybody who is a writer, I had to ask a lot of permission. You know, I was like, I don't know. I go out to Pine Ridge. I said, you want me to write this? And I was like, you know, because I'm an Ojibwe person. I did not, you know, you're afraid to write about Lakotas. You don't want to write about Lakotas and get them mad at you. So I'm like, oh, you know, but they like the story. That's good. So those are stories that I wrote. But I write them also because if you do not write these stories, then I think that you are doomed to repeat your history, you know, if you do not tell them. So then I wrote one book of fiction, which this has just come out again. It is called Last Standing Woman. And I'm going to read to you a little bit out of this and a little of this and then close my remarks. I wrote this book entirely when I was pregnant. Any other women in here have this, like, tremendous insomnia creative streak? You know, I have no idea. I'm a nonfiction writer, and this book came out of me entirely when I was pregnant, you know? And so I wrote this book about my community. But the thing about writing fiction is historical fiction, but it is about seven generations. It starts with the past and it went into the future at the time. But it is funny because the book has just been reissued and it ends in 2018. But I wrote the book in 1990, you know, so it is now almost coming to pass. But I wrote this book because I had done all these oral histories in my community, and so a lot of the stories in here are true. And it is something that is about writing about your own community, that truth is stranger than fiction. You know, the stories that my people would tell me was like, wow. You know, and so you didn't need that much embellishment, really, for some of them stories. You would just move your relatives around a little bit. And the crazy things. The Leduc women are quite an interesting bunch. There are many of them in here. But I read a little of this to you, and then I will read, and I'll tell you more about it. But the other reason I wrote it is that, you know, I don't like most futuristic movies. I don't like them. I don't like I don't like the zombie apocalypse thing. You know, I don't like all that Mad Max. I don't like all that, like, super crazy intergalactic space stuff. It bothers me. You know, it bothers my sensibilities. So I wanted to write about Native people in the future, because I think we need to be in the future, not just in the past. And so that's a little of what I wrote here. So I read to you a little bit our history, and then I read one in the future. But this is the opening. It says, "There are many migrations which brought the people here. Oma here to the place where the food grows on the water. Anishinaabe King, the people's land, the land where the manoma and the wild rice grows. It had been perhaps 1,000 years since the time the Anishinaabe had left the big waters of Wabanaki, the land of the east, and now they turned Ningobianang to the west. Each day the Migas shell appeared in the sky, and each day the people followed it. The shell was luminescent, gleaming in the sky. They traveled by foot on the land and by canoe on the rivers, traveling farther and farther to the west until they returned home. And so it was that the families, the clans, and the head people of the Anishinaabe came to the headwaters in the Mississippi, here, Gawababanikog, white earth, named for the clay, the white clay you find here. It's so beautiful it is. Here the people would remain in the good land that was theirs. The Anishinaabe world undulated between material and spiritual shadows, never clear which was more prominent at any time. It was as if the world rested in those periods rather than in the light of day, dawn and dusk. Bidabin Goshki Dipikad, the gray of sky and earth the same, the distinction between the worlds barely discernible. In the season round, the small camps, villages, and bands would plan their hunts by dream and memory, fill full their birch bark makakoons with wild rice, maple syrup, berries, dried corn, and squash. By snowshoe, canoe, or dog team, they moved through those woods, rivers, and lakes. It was not a life circumscribed by a clock, stamp, a fence, or a road. But there was a law just the same, the Creator's law that still is. And with that law was the presence of ancestors, spirits, and magic, always magic. Hunting magic, love magic, fighting magic, and the magic made between people. The spirits and the magic traveled with the Ojibwe to their hunting camps, trap lines, maple sugar bushes, across lakes, and into the small lodges warm with fires and stories. Forget the law, forget the magic, and you will be reminded. Hot fingers touched a face and burned a mark into the skin that stayed until you remembered why the mark came. Bony fingers reached through the ice to pull a greedy hunter down to Mishinameganabig, the great horned sturgeon. Gegu Gawaindam Kane, Gita Sema, those spirits whispered, do not forget your Sema, your tobacco. The white man's law was different. The white man's law was all paper. A series of 20 or so treaties by the 1860s would leave the Anishinaabe less land and more priests. One treaty took the copper and the big copper boulder. Another treaty took the iron ore. Yet another, the trees. The white man parleyed to get more than he needed. The old people, the martens, the cranes, the bears, the kingfishers, the clans, went to see the white man and talked to him. They received assurances. But in the end, the assurances were just paper, just words. The old people, however, by some fortune, did secure White Earth. Their reservation was to be a refuge for those clans. It was a good land. The Anishinaabe were mystified and astounded by the appetite of the light-skinned men and by their folly. Strange words, stranger ideas. The white man's government would have flicked aside the Anishinaabe, flicked them all aside with a stroke of a pen on a sheet of paper, except that the paper, the Massanagan, was not the land, and it was not the people, and it was not the magic. It was just the paper. You know, as I wrote that in 1990, I interviewed, and I had a lot of stories in there, and there are more to be told in there. But there's a story of a boulder, a 2,500-pound boulder known as the Ontonagon Boulder, and I thought it had disappeared. Can you imagine a giant boulder for a people like us, made of pure copper that sat on the shore of Lake Superior in the Keweenaw Peninsula, a place where Kennecott Copper and all those mining companies were founded? They took that boulder out. It took them a long time. They took that boulder. They hauled it to the Smithsonian. And so a couple of years ago, I began the beginning of my pilgrimage to see my boulder, you know. And the great guys at the Smithsonian, they always let me go there. And I go in, you know, and I ask them about this repatriation of the boulder. And, you know, I said, we like our rock back, you know. And they have these anomalies and these, like, things. And they said, well, it doesn't really fall within the qualifications of NAGPRA. You know, it is not actually a sacred site. It's not a, you know, it's not a funerary object, you know. And you're sitting there looking at these guys feeling like, are you guys high or what, you know. So this boulder, if you ever get a chance, it is at this facility. And we'd really like it back. I'm going to be working on that. But it is in the elevator, in the place right outside of the freight elevator. It is under a tarp because they cannot, there is no place which is structurally strong enough in the Smithsonian to hold it except for next to the elevator shaft. So, you know, that is a story that is not yet written. But it is a story that at one day I would like to write the story about when our rock comes home. In my last bit of writing, I'm going to read a little bit to you from my new book. And so as you know, as we are here today, you know, we are here at this moment. And, you know, as Billy Lonnie explained, I work in my community, and the ocean is rising. I read that in the New York Times yesterday, right? More, you know, in the past, like, decade than in the past, like, 36 centuries. We're going up. You know, the temperature is rising. We are combusting ourselves to the edge of oblivion. We are in this fossil fuel era where we have entered this era, not just of fossil fuels, but of copper, of extreme extraction, where that which is left, you have to either frack the bedrock of Mother Earth, carve away the entire Athabascan River to shove it in some pipeline, or blow off the top of mountains in Appalachia. We have done not well with nature. And we are in this moment, you know, our ancestors call this the time of the seventh fire. And they say that we have a choice between two paths at this time. They said one path is well-worn but scorched, and the second is not well-worn and it is green. And it is our choice upon which path to embark. And so as an Anishinaabe Kwe, or as a human being in this moment in time, you reflect on what you can write that will be of consequence and help in this moment. Because it is really this collective time when all of us must do the right thing. You know, there's really no way out of it. And whoever we are, it is our moment. It is our moment to take responsibility for changing consciousness in the broader society, in whatever way that will be. And through that, changing, whether it is policy or changing economics. You know, so in my community, I try so hard to, you know, I live in my community for 35 years, you know, since I got out of college, basically, 1981, I got out, I moved back there. I live a little bit here, there, but I live there, you know. And I moved to a place where there was no things that I was used to fighting. There was no big dam projects. There was no uranium or coal. And I thought, oh, we are good. I will rest and work in my community. You know, and so we defended our rice from genetic engineering, and we defeated those proposals by Monsanto and others to genetically engineer our wild rice. took about 8 years. You know, we did that. All these things take time. And then one day I wake up and I hear that they want to run tar sands and fracked oil pipelines across the largest wild rice bed on my reservation. And I think to myself, that was a really dumb idea. And I look up and I say, what are you going to do? You know, and I know in my little way that I have the most experience of anybody on my reservation in fighting oil companies. So now will probably be the time to cowboy up, you know. So my first job, I started writing again, you know, about our rice. But I decide my first job is to write for all the local kind of redneck papers. You know, well, they're conservative. We'll go with that. You know, in these small towns, from Fargo to Grand Forks to Park Rapids to Bemidji to Duluth, you know, I start writing repeatedly for these people. And I start writing about what is coming our way. Because the thing is that these companies move very fast. They move behind closed doors with a lot of policymakers. Well, you know that. You live in New Mexico. That is how stuff happens, right? And so, you know, I'm trying to do the same thing as I did in 1979 and 1980, is get a bunch of people really informed quickly. And so my goal was to get a bunch of Norwegians mad. And so I wrote for all these papers, and I was like, hey, this company, Enbridge, largest pipeline company in the world, is coming your way, and they want to throw these pipes across your territory, and they've had 800 leaks in the past decade, including that Kalamazoo spill. That'd be theirs. And so, you know, all you northern lakeshore owners and people who fish, time would be to get out of that lull of your happy life and stand up for something that would mean something, you know? And so that was my work. For a couple years, I start, and so those Norwegians are hopping mad in the north now. They file some lawsuits. We push the company back after these years. But, you know, I'm in this, it is a very big battle. But it is the battle that everyone is fighting, because it turns out to get the oil out of the tar sands, you got to go through Indian communities. Someplace you have to go. And so our reservation is facing 1.4 million barrels of oil right now. You know, and looking down the barrel of a pipeline is not a good thing to do. You know, and when you're on the other end looking down it, you don't see the world very well. And so I've been, you know, battling this company since 2013. And, you know, I had to resign from a lot of other work, because it takes full time to fight bad guys, you know, when you're doing this. And so a lot of my writing kind of, you know, got put to the side. But this book just came out. I read from you for this book, and then I close with a little bit. But this book here was written, it's called Chronicles, and it came out 2 weeks ago. Isn't that great? I'm, like, super proud of myself. I was writing till the end. But this book, I have to tell you where this book came from, which is, it is in the introduction called After the Burn. What we know is that after the fields, the forest floor, and the prairies are burned, new growth comes. There is new life. That is what happens after the burn. That is this book. November of 2008, my home burned. This happens. It happened to our family, and our family consisted of myself and 8 dependents under 20 years of age. My community and many people I did not know and had never seen came to support us. People sent clothing, blankets, books, money, prayers, and love. Solar Energy International gave our family a solar photovoltaic system. Many, many people helped us. Women sent me jewelry and old beadwork. Someone told me they loved me and respected my family and myself. And someone even sent me a navy blue bra from Victoria's Secret, which fit nicely. That was funny. That's all I'll say, and I'm tremendously grateful. We're all grateful, this family of mine. So it is 8 years later, and in the interim, many days I couldn't write. Many days I couldn't sleep. Many days I couldn't remember what day it was. And amidst it all, I had many losses. I lost those I loved the most. I lost my father. I lost the father of my children, and I lost my sister. I continued to spin in despair and, frankly, had a hard time breathing and getting a grip. I became a casualty of the PTSD of the modern Indian Wars. And in my spin, I lost my love, my heart, and some of my closest friends. Sort of hit the rock bottom. Yet amidst it all, it seems that one must go on. I found solace in writing when it came back, and I found myself more in love with the words and with the story. In a way, I began a new life as a modern-day bard, someone who was able to travel across the land and share stories from other lands. And then I began to rebuild. I built a home for my family, a home almost completely of salvage and from Craigslist. I became a bit of a Craigslist junkie. It worked out pretty well. And one day it'll be done and perfect. Maybe. Although through all of it, the stories carried me. They became my escape from my depression, my fears, and they also became a way to help others. Having said all this, I hope you understand and accept my apologies if I cannot remember something or you. For those who choose to read this writing, in that traumatic stress that I've suffered during those past 4 years, I could not remember what I wrote. And sometimes I could not remember what I did. And sometimes I cannot remember people. This is not uncommon. This is what happens with PTSD. And so it is that I decided to look at myself, look at all my writing, and look through my computers and my journals and my notes to see if I could remember my journey. That is this book. And so, in closing, perhaps the best for last, I read you a little bit from my last essay, which is called Emma, From a Teepee to a Tesla. And this is a tribute to a woman named Emma Lockridge. I am facing a pipeline. That is by the Enbridge Company. And that pipeline is intended to go to Boynton in Michigan, which is the dirtiest postal code in Michigan, which is where the Marathon oil refinery has its refinery, and it is right next to the house of a woman named Emma Lockridge. And so I wrote this story for her. I read you just a little bit from it. I would like to drive a couple of cars in the next few years. I would like to drive a Jaguar. Not own one, just drive one, cross the Golden Gate Bridge. Maybe navy blue or slate gray. Maybe a real old school car, like an old Chevy. A rounded edge one, no sharp fins. Why would I like to do this? Because in their own way, they are works of art to me. Perhaps to all of us. Beautiful works of art created in a fossil fuel era. And that era will soon be over, because it's time. It's time to move on. I just want to see an elegant transition, not a crashing my way out of the fossil fuel era in climate change and poison. The reason I know that the fossil fuel era will end is a simple energy efficiency problem. Of the 6 gallons of gas you put into a car, only 1 gallon actually moves the car forward. That's not smart. And it won't be sustained. So I was reading my Harvard magazine. They still send it to me after 35 years. So they also still send me those requests to donate to the Harvard Fund. I don't know if y'all get those, but I'm wondering why they have not got the memo that I have not donated in 35 years. But anyway, I'm reading this article about Mara Prentice. And one day I'd like to meet her. She's like super intelligent. But she said this. The most wasteful example is the gasoline-powered car driven in the city. The inefficiency begins with the engine itself, subject to the Carnot limit. The thermal engine loss exceeds 65% of the energy in the fuel burned, and it mounts from there. Drivetrain loss is 4%, friction loss 6%, other engine loss is 11%. In the final analysis, 16% of the energy actually moves the wheels. So what does that mean? It means that that's got to be the dumbest thing you could drive. 65% inefficient. You know what I'm saying? That's like pretty dumb. It's 65% of the energy just in the fuel itself. It's only 11% efficient. And then you compare that to something like a Tesla, which is 65% efficient. So there's something in me that understands that where we are now is where we're not going to be in 10 years. Because how stupid could you be to stay with that inefficient of an economy? So I had this really interesting thing happen to me last June. I was asked to speak. I don't know how I got this gig. I do know, but it was crazy. I was asked to speak to the Minority Chrysler Dealers Association of America. And we were at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs. Any of you ever been there? That was like the most expensive hotel in the world, right? You know, it's like $500 a night hotel. I was like, I go in there and there's only 90 of them in the Minority Chrysler Dealers Association of America. And what they wanted me to talk about was the green economy and the post-fossil fuel era. Let us call this moment awkward. It was really, really, really awkward. You know, what are you going to say? Like, I'm like, guys, move on. It was like so painful. Anyway, I sweated through the whole thing, lasted, that it went as well as could be expected. But, you know, in closing this story, you know, Emma is my age. She has a big, you know, thing here because she lost a kidney. They just got an air monitor from the EPA. You know, and black people should not be living in the shadow of a refinery. We shouldn't have those refineries anywhere. They are so filthy. And what I understood from her was that we were linked. You know, our stories are the same stories. And she came to my community, and you know what she said when she came to my reservation? We put her on hearing to testify. She said, I can breathe. That's what she said, I can breathe. And so, you know, to me, that is where we are at. We're at this moment where we have done so much. And if you want to see that the fossil fuel era is working well, just look at Flint in Detroit. You know, that's a pretty good example of how things are not working out down that path. So as I think about where it is that we are going, I finish with one short story, which is 3 years ago or 2 years ago, maybe. I think I was in Washington, D.C. with the Cowboys and Indians fighting the Keystone XL pipeline. Now, that's pretty good. We did get that thing stopped, huh? The Keystone pipeline, right? Nobody thought we had a prayer in hell at that, you know? And those are some, you know, that's pretty plucky, those Cowboys, and those Lakotas never give up. You know, so that worked out, but a long battle. So they asked me and my sister Lorna, to go out and ride horse, because we've been riding horse on these pipelines in northern Minnesota. They asked us to go ride horse with them. We're super honored, you know, so I go out there. And any of you who ride horse, you know that the last place you probably want to ride horse is in Washington, D.C. So I'm on this horse, you know, this giant horse. I'm on this horse, and I'm sitting next to my sister on another horse, and there's like 30 of us on horseback. And there are like, you know, police lights going like this, you know, and there are, you know, sirens over here, and then there are crowds, and then there are people with banners going like this. And I am almost ready to weep on the back of this horse, although I'm supposed to be praying. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's like horribly terrifying. And then of course, there's the one idiot reporter who is up like this in front of your horse's nose. And you're thinking, you're going to get killed, buddy, you know. But anyway, we survive. So I'm riding my horse. I get off my horse at the Washington Mall, where I have a teepee on the Washington Mall. How cool is that, right? Like, I have a teepee on the Washington Mall. Lakotas are there. They have the 8 Lakota teepees, and then there's the Ojibwe teepee. You know, we're a little further away because we didn't get to be in the sacred circle of the Lakota teepees, so we're in the sacred circle all by ourselves with the Ojibwe teepee. So, you know, we're over there in our teepee, and I'm hanging out in my teepee on the Washington Mall. God, how cool I think that is, huh? So I'm hanging out in my teepee in Washington Mall. And then I leave my teepee, and then at that point, of course, is when Daryl Hannah and Neil Young come in the teepee in the Washington Mall, and they're hanging out in the teepee, and I'm, you know, so all these cool people are going there and hanging out. And so then I go back in my teepee, and I go in there, and my two then 14-year-old boys are in the teepee. And they, you know, I'm hanging out with my boys in the teepee, and then this guy comes and sticks his head in the door of the teepee, and is, he looks at me, and he says, Ms. LeDuc, would you like to go for a ride in my car? And I'm like looking at him thinking, that is such a great pickup line from the 80s, buddy. You know? I am 54 years old and I don't know you. Why would I do that, you know? And my boys are looking at me and they're going, no, Mom, you are not going for a ride in that man's car. We don't know who that man is and you are not going. You know, two 14-year-old boys, they're like, you know, they're like, no, Mom. And I'm looking at that man and he says, it's a Tesla. And I'm like, yes, I would like to go for a ride in your car. So I walked out of my teepee into a red 4-door Tesla. And we went to see my friend Ralph Nader. And that's basically what I want. That's what I want. And that's this story is called From a Teepee to a Tesla because of that, because that's what I want. I don't want any third-rate technology. I don't want some, like, transition with a bunch of fracked natural gas, you know, on the way to the next economy. I want to walk out of my teepee into a Tesla, and that's what we all deserve. Thank you for your time.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
You know, Winona and I were laughing. She recently came to Hawaii. We were talking about this event and how we were going to be sharing our stories. But when I was sitting in the audience and I heard her say, naming several of you out there, how she had met you, sleeping on your couches. Well, you know what? 35 years ago, that's how I met Winona. I went to work one day, came back home, and he was this Indian woman who was sick on my couch. I had gotten a call from the Protect Koho'olawe Ohana. She had come to support us because they were using our sacred island of Koho'olawe as a military bombing target. But she was so sick with the flu, she could not go on the boat. We didn't have money for a boat to take us to the land, so we went as close as we could, and then we jumped off, and we swam in. In the beginning, we had ropes, but she was so sick, she couldn't make it. They left her at my house on the couch. I came home. She was there for 2 days. She did not get up. She did not speak. Then I told them, when I found out who she was, I woke her up on the morning of the third day and said, hey, you're coming to the doctor with me because you're somebody, and if you die here, I will never live through it. But, you know, this is how we began many years ago. And just recently, Winona has come back to help us with our trying to protect our sacred site of Mauna Kea. For many years, she helped educate our people about what GMOs were. Many don't know that Hawaii is the GMO capital of the United States of America and in the top 5 GMO places of the world. All of the GMO corn and other things come from Hawaii. They have taken now and control the island of Kauai and other islands, other places as well. But with the help of our sister, we resist them. And one of the things Winona has done is brought in my vocabulary. As we oppose the GMO, we are bringing in the IMO, the indigenous organisms that replenish the earth, so that species that we have been told have vanished will come back. And this is how we're bringing back the silver sword in our sacred Mauna Kea. The land has been destroyed and devalued, but we're bringing back and mulching all of the endemic species that used to be there 100 years ago. And lo and behold, the baby silver swords are coming up. So now we know, fight the GMO with the IMO. You know, Winona, I wanted to ask you something you had said when we were talking to prepare for this, that you view your writing, you write really only about 3 topics, and they are hope, they are resiliency, and they are land. In many books that I've read and many of the articles that you've written, there's another thread that you didn't say. Maybe it is part of land, maybe it is part of hope. But the spiritual wellspring is what I'm addressing, and I'm so happy to see that the book that you are writing, that you wrote many years ago about the spiritual practices of our indigenous peoples, is now going to be reprinted. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. You talk about ceremony, but how is the spiritual wellspring in terms of your own practice, someone who has done the sweat lodge and many other things as well?
Well, I think that, you know, I am like you. I mean, you know, it's funny, she's talking about Hawaii. So my first, excuse me, I have to digress. So I go there and I want to go help the Hawaiians, you know, but they don't tell me that the island, you don't get off like the plane with the red carpet. They don't tell me that. Kaho'olawe was bombed by the United States for many years. It's the Hawaiian island that you don't get to see, you know. But through their long, they've been worked many years. So 79, 78 or 79 is, I think, when I first went there. And the first accesses were like 74, 75?
Yeah.
They started going there. So what they do, you know, Hawaiians are good swimmers. I'm a lake swimmer. I'm not an ocean swimmer. You get close, and then they basically throw you off the boat, and you have to swim to shore. I was like, you know, so my first time, I'm like, you know, I'm like in a panic. And then I look, and the Hawaiians are kind of like dolphins. They're like cruising along, you know, to get there. And that's when I think it was a great test of my faith, you know. I was like, pray hard. Be okay. It's going to be okay. Just be with your people there. Learn from your people, you know. But I think I'm like a lot of people in the room, you know, in that I know that that how we reaffirm, you know, they say that our native spiritual practice, I don't know, but they, you know, I think that they say native spiritual practice is a little distinguished from some other spiritual practices, more mainstream religions. They refer to those as sometimes as commemorative religions, you know, commemorating significant dates and significant things in history of those spiritual practices that occurred, and then the teachings that come from that. In our case, they say that our religious practice is often called reaffirmation religions, and that we reaffirm our relationship to place and to spiritual beings through our practice, you know, on a consistent basis. And so, you know, in my life, you know, a lot of what we do is founded in that. And a lot of our, you know, in our my lifetime, when I came back to my community, we had lost all our ceremonial drums. And they were taken by museums and collectors, and one was up in the rafters of the Episcopal Church. And I saw in about 88, 89, I saw our first drums come home. And now of the 13 that were there, there are five that are there. And what I know is that in our community, whether it is those drums or maybe it is our boulder or maybe it is our people or maybe it is our sacred items, when they come home, our people are better, you know. And I've seen that in my own life. And then I've seen, for people, some of you know me that I cannot say I'm a farmer because I know that my friend Clayton and his wife Margaret are here and Emigdio is here as well. You know, those are real farmers. I'm a gardener, but I grow corn, and I work to bring back our old varieties of my area. And one reason I do that is because my father passed away many years ago, but he came to see me one day at Harvard, and he said, Winona, I don't want to hear you're a smart woman, but I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. I've been growing, but a lot of my spiritual practice, I would say, is also in preparing the foods for the spiritual practice. I grow the foods to make sure that our ceremonies have our food.
Yeah. The wellspring of our health.
Mm-hmm. That is also the wellspring of our health.
You know, I wanted to talk a little bit about the big battles that we're all in right now for sustainability. And the real question is energy. In Hawaii, we are considered to be the state that would have the easiest time getting off of fossil fuel, that we have the ability in Hawaii to be completely energy self-sufficient. We have sufficient wind tunnels already identified. We have significant sunlight. We are a collective of small islands divided by channels. And despite this and existing technology, in all these years, we haven't been able to get a single project that generates energy from tide, wave, or surge from the sea. When I hear you talking about the fossil fuel threat, it seems to me that we're not making too much progress in trying to shift the energy paradigm away from fossil fuels. And it's even more disturbing to see what the state of Hawaii is doing now. A year and a half ago, we paid $4.40 for a gallon of gas on the island of Hawaii. In Hana, Maui, they paid over $5. Now everyone is so happy. It's back down to $2.80, and it's because of the importing of liquid natural gas. We have started to try to educate in our community what that means to people that live in the continent and to those communities, because fracking is destroying them, and we have yet to see really the full impact of fracking. I think when you take a look at what you're confronting there at White Earth, the pipelines, the day of the pipeline, you would think would be long over, given the fact that we now won the big battle. We really have convinced the world that there is a climate change crisis and that the polar caps are melting. But nevertheless, we continue to have this problem with those that are pushing fossil fuel energy and now saying that we can safely harvest the liquid natural gas. You know, it's a fracking lie, but no one knows it. Nobody knows it. And I was wondering if in your work you would found anything to address this. Well, I try to be positive when my work. This is one big difference between the two of us. Winona is always guided by hope, but I don't know. Possibly it's getting older, menopause. I don't know what, but I don't really feel like, you know, engaging in a positive way with these guys.
Yeah. Yeah. To be honest, Hawaii is like one of the most difficult places, you know, because colonialism is, and it's isolation and basically the rule of oligarchy, you know. It's not exclusive to Hawaii, of course, but it is pretty entrenched power. You know, to be punished for putting solar panels on your house is baffling. But that is the way of these utilities, you know, across the country. And so, you know, I wrote this letter. You can find it on our Honor the Earth website. It was in part inspired by my friend Ralph Nader, whose most recent book is called Unanswered Letters to the President. You know, and so I started this correspondence with Al Monaco, who's the president of Enbridge. And I wrote him a little letter. You know, I was like, hey, Al, I know you don't really know me down here, northern Minnesota. You're trying to run some pipelines down here, but I couldn't help notice, you know, things are not going well for you. You know, you had a $610 million loss posted on your balance sheets. You know, you're losing pipelines up in Canada, and this new guy, I think he's named Premier Trudeau, came in, not a big fan of a lot of things you're doing. Things are kind of, the writing's a little on the wall there, Al. You know, and then you're trying to run this pipeline down through here, and you know, you're having some problems here and there. You hire your Indian whispers. He hired two Indian whispers. They both got fired. I said, you know, the whispering is not going well.
Yeah.
You know, no Indians will talk to this company up in northern Minnesota. We're like, you know, we're suing them. They're not going to talk to you. We're not getting on. So, but in the end of the letter, I'm like, Al, it's quite obvious that, you know, your math is not good. You know, because there are more jobs in solar than there are in the United States. Now, there are more jobs in solar than there are in the oil fields. You know, the industry is growing rapidly and dramatically. It's cheaper to put in solar and wind than it is to put in new fossil fuel generation. Pipelines are things that they're called stranded assets. You know, it's like the little economic term. So you build something now, you spend $21 billion on new pipelines. That is $21 billion of junk that you're going to have in 10 years or 15 years. And it is, you know, quite clear in this country. You know, the United States has a D in infrastructure. We're a first world country with a D in infrastructure. You know, that is something that I cannot understand. You know, you have bridges that collapse. You have gas mains that explode in major cities. You know, we are a disaster in infrastructure, and yet we are looking at this massive infusion of new infrastructure that only benefits oil companies. And that is what, you know, to me makes no sense. You know, I'm not opposed to pipelines. I just don't like dirty oil pipelines. You know, I like water and sewer. I'm first world. You know, I like things that work. And so a lot of my analysis is really, like I said, this teepee to a Tesla, these final days of the fossil fuel era, the final days of extreme extraction, whether it is at Oak Flats or whether it is in northern Minnesota, when they're going to take a million tons of waste to get a ton of copper. That's what they're going to do. And the amount of energy that is required to get that bottom of the barrel copper is so immense that it requires a massive energy infrastructure. Enlightened countries don't do things like that. You know, obviously all of that was set up for the unenlightened. And the point is now is to accelerate the move towards an enlightened pathway. And that is really our work.
You know, when I look at some of the struggles that we were taking on 30 and 35 years ago, we still seem to be fighting to protect those sacred sites. We still seem to be fighting to roll back militarism. And I wanted to just say that, you know, from generation to generation, these struggles continue. But we cannot just measure our success by looking at where we are now, because there's been such a great evolution. And I really do think that there was a time when indigenous peoples were so marginalized that our cultural practices and our spiritual beliefs and the traditional knowledge that we held that provide the solution for many of the problems in the world, that these things were really lost, that we could never reclaim them. But I see much hope in where we are now. Since the 60s, there's been a great deal of communication and a great melding between indigenous peoples and environmentalists, between indigenous peoples and those who are committed to developing green and clean energy. And so I see that there really is some kind of an underlying shift going on. We were at the United Nations.
In the basement?
Yes, we were trying to find a place to do an interview, and there was no place, so we wound up somehow being in the gym of the YMCA.
Basement, women's locker room.
Yeah, that's right, it was the women's locker room. We were there trying with this tape to try to record some of our reflections on this. And we talked about the fact that some progress was being made. I look at this now, and I'm really uplifted by it. We see more and more collaboration, and that's something that I wanted to address here, because we no longer can really afford the luxury of feeling that we can be isolated, that we can somehow step back and say, well, this is a problem. You know, there's this rioting going on now in India, and when you see it on TV, you wonder what is at the bottom of it. And then when the story is done, the rioting is occurring because there isn't any fresh water for people to drink there. And those kinds of realities in today's world are very close to us. We think we are insulated because somehow we live in the most powerful and wealthy country of the world. But when you look at what is happening with our energy, what is happening with our water, the basic things that we need for survival, we will lose it. And that is why it's important for us as indigenous women and advocates to always affirm that we have to move forward with partnerships. Partnerships with those who may not be indigenous, but having faith that they can understand that we all live on the same planet, that we all have the same requirements for our survival. And I do see some hope in that, although I don't see much in the current presidential debates. I'm really kind of worried about that. But nevertheless, I think that we've made some progress, and I think that a lot of it, you know, is credit to your work. There was a time when I certainly would not have worked with environmentalists. I couldn't understand why I would. Being a Hawaiian, Kanaka Maoli, our job is to work with our peoples. But it is a lesson that you taught all of us. And the thing is that we're living in a shrinking world beset with poverty and violence. And we're not going to be able to turn it around. We are too few. We need to bring along as many as we can. And we actually see now some positive change with the states, with the nation states. because the poorer states in the world are beginning to realize that they are indigenous states, and it is their resources that are being removed. The extractive industries, now these are the primary reason for violation of human rights of indigenous peoples all over the world, but especially in Africa, certainly in the Pacific, Central and South America, mining. The thing is that we all need to struggle against it. There was a time when we talked about the need to share our beliefs. And at that time, there was some resistance to it, but I see more and more now that there's an understanding, and those that are indigenous and those that are not, that we have a lot of common ground. And I think that that's going to be a wellspring for our future. I know that you have had a great deal of background in working with the environmental movement, and I'm very thankful for the work that you've been doing with this slow food movement. It is actually helping us find and reclaim some of the endemic species of our own peoples that we thought were lost. And this is what has happened with our food, with your help and others. We thought that some of the traditional species of the corn had been lost to the Indian countries. We thought that the species of the taro, at one time we had 200, we only had 25 left. And this is what science told us. But of course, the indigenous peoples from the continent said, don't believe them. Go back to your traditional lands. Go back to the wild places. Find the species that have survived. We did it. We now have 85 species of the kalo. And I know that the Indian nations have found their corn as well. So we need to reclaim some of these things. And you know, when I look at that, I think of sustainable food crops and what it does to keep us going. And it does go back to what you wrote in that book about reclaiming the sacred, naming it, identifying it.
You know, I think it's really the work that we all do. I mean, because a lot of anything I wrote is really a reflection of what I learned from people. And, I've owed a great debt to the Hawaiians for, you know, the many gifts that have been given to me and, you know, and all the great food I eat.
With indigenous, it usually comes down to the food.
Yeah, it does.
And the music.
And the music. But I just want to, you know, in our last minutes here, I just want to say that, you know, an example perhaps of, the alliance and also the moment and how you look over, you know, years and see how things change. I was just in Hawaii a few weeks ago. I'd gone there, and this Mililani and I sat together as two women of a good vintage on her porch for many hours and talked. And I asked her to tell me many stories, because that's what I usually do when I go to Hawaii. But I've been following this case of the telescope, the 30-meter telescope. How many of you have heard of that story? Giant telescope on Mauna Kea. Brand new telescope they want to put up, their biggest telescope in the world. It does look like a giant eyeball. It's like crazy looking thing, you know? And it's very similar to the story of the Apache and Mount Graham. Yes. The story of, you know, I always wonder why the Pope needed a telescope down there. I never could understand why the Pope needed a scope. The Pope's scope, yeah.
Yeah, the Pope's scope.
Pope's scope,
Mount Graham, I remember the Pope's scope, right.
The Pope's scope. So this is a similar story. It's a sacred mountain that now they want to put a telescope on. And the Hawaiians are done. You know, they're done. They have been so abused by America. They've been militarized. Their land has been taken. They're covered with GMOs. They're, you know, what little bit they have left, what little scraps they have left is small. And then their political rights are stripped with things like the Rice Decision, you know, which now allows non-Hawaiians to vote for Hawaiian, you know, for Hawaiian trustees. It is really baffling how bad Hawaiians have it, you know. So I go there again this year, and I go always to go pray at the mountain and go pray here, there, you know, and see these people. And this year, there was this case where a lot of people got arrested, right?
Yes.
Trying to stop the construction crews for coming to the mountain. And, you know, as a testimony to Mililani and many other great Hawaiian activists, this one young man stood up, what's his name? And in his testimony at court, he defended himself and he spoke only Hawaiian.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
That was cool.
which was a problem we addressed several years ago. They forgot about it. We actually had a rule passed in the courts in Hawaii several years ago that we have two languages. One is English and the other is Hawaiian. But years passed and they never had a Hawaiian who stood up and addressed the court. And they just didn't know what to do. They had to stop the proceedings and find a Hawaiian translator. But our language has returned.
Yeah, see that it is, their language has returned. And this young man, he's under 30, yeah?
Yeah, there were many of the young ones arrested, my nephew as well. But I think you're speaking of Lanakila Manguel. The youth, we were so proud that they went. And when I got the call, I told my nephew, watch our back, and especially because the police were coming, and they always come armed. That is the only way they come. We try to not practice violence, and we're very proud that in Hawaii, in our struggle, we have not. We have had only one incident where the gun was taken, and the Hawaiians themselves went up and brought it down so that we would maintain peace. But, you know, I got the call. It looks like the arrests are coming. And when my nephew was taken to jail, we went down to bail him out. I was so proud that he would be arrested for sacred site. I told him, you follow the footsteps of your aunties. Rather be arrested for that than drunk driving or something like that. And that's how it used to be with our people. Only those kind of criminal arrests. Now we are being arrested for the right reasons.
That's right. That's right. And so we are very thankful to the young people. Mililani and I will probably be arrested again in our golden age here.
But we haven't been arrested together yet.
We have not. That is yet to come, I'm sure. But I want to say, and it just as a last note, because she is a lawyer. She is one of the most renowned indigenous lawyers in the world. And she has graced us to come here for today and join with us, you know. I asked her for a story on this case because one of my, I call him my brother, Brother Craig, right? Craig Neff is also arrested. Kind of a, you know, the silent, stoic Hawaiian guy. Fair description?
Yes. Yeah.
You know, don't really get out there. He's like, you go brah. You know, he's like, sits, he's like, cool dude, man, does all this stuff. He got arrested too. And in the defense of Mauna Kea, their sacred place. And Mililani explained to me that as Craig went up there in his defense, what is the defense called?
The defense is called the defense of necessity. Sometimes it's referred to as the lesser of two evil defenses. You never hear about it other than in law school. And when the case comes up where the police have shot someone and killed them, the necessity defense is a defense where you say, yes, I did it. But I had to do it. If I did not shoot this person, he would have killed another. And so I had to break the law. I had to do this in order to prevent a greater evil from occurring. And this is a very argument that they make. Many, many were arrested, but only two went to trial. And the first was Craig Neff. And when the judge asked him why he had blocked the road and obstructed the government operations, he said that he had done it in order to prevent a greater evil, the desecration of our sacred place, of our sacred land, something that we had to maintain, that he had no choice. The judge believed him. The case was dismissed. And when we went to the Supreme Court, and we told them that many years ago, we had come through the process, we told them, this is a sacred place, and we object to the development. We had a right to a contested case hearing, but the state instead delayed the hearing for years while they allowed 13 telescopes to be built on our sacred mauna. If you go there now, you will see that there are 22 structures. How was it possible when they only had a plan for 13? Well, they Hawaiianized it. They put up a big Keck telescope, and then later they wanted to put 6 little baby ones around it. And when we said, hey, that was not in the EIS, they said, no, but we Hawaiianized it. The big telescope is actually a canoe, and the little ones are amas.
their outriggers to support the big canoe. Well, the Supreme Court threw that out, and that is where we are today. We're still waiting for contested case. Now we hear last week that TMT may move to another country. So quickly, we're sending emails to the indigenous peoples in Chile. Heads up, because that's where the big telescopes will go. But I tell you, we will not allow any further. We will go for a rest, but we will not allow any further telescopes there.
So, you know, in closing, I ask her to tell you that story in part because history is made by people who do things now. You know, it is not made by others. And to see my, you know, my longtime friends and this man, Craig, get arrested and then use this necessity defense, which she explained to me has only been used successfully about twice in 30 or 40 years.
Yeah. And but we set the precedent now for sacred site defense.
And that the Hawaiians have set a precedent for sacred site defense in this case. That is really cultural expression and cultural freedom. And that is, you know, what we are asked to talk about here. But that is also, you know, as Indigenous women and as people who are in our communities and those who write about it or those who litigate it and stand for it, it is history that is being made today. So thank you again so much for coming.
Thank you so much. Aloha.
You've been listening to a Lanin podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lanin.org. In addition, the Lanin Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lanin.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.